It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to cover in just 29 minutes. So let's start out with local.
TikTok.
I guess they've been having reports lately that jobs are up. They've been creating more in Seattle and Washington State, and I guess a bunch of those have now been attributed to the monorail.
Yeah, the news this week was that the monorail was going to cut some jobs, and I'm sure most other people were as appalled as I was to learn that the monorail folks employ 68 people in the pre-planning stages of the monorail. I was thinking, oh my God, what do those 68 people do? And then the board comes out and tells us, well, we may be cutting jobs. And I thought that was pretty comical. What do you mean?
Well,
you may
and not
be
only,
cutting
and not
jobs.
Only that, but of the 68 people employed there, a number of them had jobs in the you know, $100,000 range.
Yeah.
I mean, it was not just jobs, but very pricey jobs.
Yeah, so who's been overseeing all this? I mean, we elected these board members to keep an eye on Joel Horn, and it turns out most of them are just sort of yes men, you know, and it makes you wonder if maybe they're doing what politicians do in a country like Iraq, for example, where you just bring your friends into the government too, pay them a salary, you know. I don't know. So that was pretty appalling. And then Cleve Stockmeyer has the gall, you know, they talk about...
This is the quote of the week.
They're talking about looking for a new director, new head of the monorail to replace Joel Horn, and they're out there doing a search, and they said that they're not necessarily looking for someone with public transit experience, and Cleve Stockmeyer says, quote, "My preference would be for that, but I think any major agency experience would do, because they don't have to build a transit system." I read that and I thought, what do you mean? They do have to build the transit system.
No, they don't. They could just shut the whole thing down.
They're just there to, you know, collect the money and pay it out. You know, I mean, you're building a transit system, okay, you know? So these are the kind of people we have on the monorail board. Clearly something has to change there in order for the monorail to be salvaged, if it can be salvaged at this point.
Well, it doesn't seem like it's looking very good for even salvage possibilities, so.
Well, they have some options. I mean, one thing they can do is they can shorten the line like Sound Transit has done with the light rail line. They can ask voters to increase taxes. They can find some other way to come up with revenue. They can sign the current contract offer and start building it and hope that they can collect more revenue somewhere. Or they can change some of the contractor liability rules that allow another company like Bombardier to put in a bid too that might be lower than the current bid that they have from Hitachi. Or they could just say, the heck with it, we're disbanding. I mean, there are other options that can happen besides just sitting around letting it implode.
One of the reasons they're sort of in a hard place is that if they make any major changes to the route at this point, if they shorten it or whatnot, there's a very good chance they would have to go back to the voters with that. And people may roll their eyes at a fifth or sixth or 23rd or whatever it is vote on the monorail. But at this point, with the proven incompetence and lack of oversight of the monorail project, any kind of a vote like that would be pretty perilous for the monorail project.
Yeah.
It could be like the school levies. It's just something you regularly vote on every, you know, couple of years.
Or they could approach it the way they approach the school levies. They just keep voting on it until they get the vote they want.
Or they could get some brains on the board and they could say, look, Sound Transit has federal money and it's got other ways of raising funds. Why can't we have that kind of stuff going on here too? And they can start looking outside of the box of just collecting car tab taxes or just collecting the auto license tax and trying to cobble together some kind of really expensive borrowing scheme. They need to start looking at other options.
Well, and here's an idea outside the box. Why do we have five different transit agencies, all with independent taxing authority? I mean, why can't we combine some of these different efforts and have more of a streamlined regional transportation system?
Yeah, well, we'd need a regional transportation board that functions for that to happen, and so far that hasn't happened.
That's true.
All right, moving along, the The top two primary, it looks like a judge has thrown it out.
Right out there. We're going to go back to a primary vote that that is going to force people. You're not going to like this. You're going to have to choose which political party you want to be a member of in order to pick up a ballot. That's where we now stand with the primary system. The judge in Olympia threw out the top two primary system. I believe it was yesterday. Ruled it unconstitutional. This is something that the political parties, the Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians, brought. Andy McKenna, the state attorney general, says he will appeal this, but chances are pretty good that come the primary system in September, the next time we have a primary vote, we're gonna have to pick which political party we want to be a member of, and should pick up a ballot for only non-denominational or nonpartisan political offices, and for those political parties,
which is what we did at the last election, wasn't it? That you had
we
to
did,
select
yeah.
which party
we
you
did.
Know.
Yeah, we did something similar to that. Yes.
Yeah, that's because the law, as it was passed through the legislature, was written that the top two primary was the preferred. Primary system, but then if it was declared unconstitutional, that then it would go back to a Montana-style primary. And when Governor Locke was supposed to sign that bill, he actually vetoed the top two primary portion, and leaving that left the Montana primary where you have to pick your party. And so that's how the last election was run.
And then we had the Grange initiative in November, which reimposed the top two primary, and that's what was just thrown out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, next up, the Enron looks like it's going to have to pay some money back. Looks like they owe.
Yeah. This lawsuit has been going on for a really, really long time. And finally, on Friday, Enron Corp. agreed to a settlement of $1.552 billion to pay back the energy utilities that it had overcharged for power during the energy crisis. Now, that $1.552 billion settlement is just a number that is kind of what these companies have asked for. What Enron will actually be able to pay is much, much lower, because they're going through bankruptcy proceedings. Their assets total a lot less than that $1.552 billion number. And they have a whole bunch of private creditors who have to be paid first. For example, there's a bunch of private corporations, you know, big corporations that they owe money to, like El Paso Corp, Duke Energy, Dynegy, Mirant, Williams Company, all these other big energy conglomerates. They all are in line to get paid first, and they have a settlement of $3 billion with Enron. So what's likely to happen is that energy ratepayers here in Washington State, we may get, our utilities may get, 10 to 20 cents on the dollar of what they were hoping to get from Enron. So for one thing, it's a good thing that Enron has to pay back something to these utilities. On the other hand, what they're paying is so small that it's a bit of a joke.
What would be the ballpark of what you think they probably really owe for everything they scammed on people?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to know, because I haven't had a chance to look at what they owe private energy companies, and what they owe, you know, their other creditors. There are other creditors that they probably owe money to, too. Okay. But this $1.5 billion is what they owe, you know, California utilities, Oregon and Washington utilities, and some other places around the country, too.
And this represents the money from when the false energy crisis of winter 2000, when they ripped off consumers for exorbitant amounts of money.
Yeah, and the state of California had to step in and deal with the bankruptcy of some private utilities in the state.
Okay. Because the Bush administration wouldn't do anything.
Yeah, and then Washington state ratepayers saw their energy bills go way up to pay for that energy.
So this is the monetary penalty. Was there any jail time for anybody involved in this?
Well, I think a lot of that's still going on right now. There's one guy who got sentenced this week, but that was a different company altogether. That was WorldCom CEO Bernard Ebbers got a 25-year prison sentence for accounting fraud when it came
to the collapse.
Yeah, really bad accounting fraud when it came to the collapse of WorldCom, an $11 billion accounting fraud. Now, the interesting thing is this whole Enron stuff kind of shows that, because if you remember, Enron had its crisis, and then WorldCom came along and had a much bigger collapse right afterwards. And the focus this week has been mostly on WorldCom. It hasn't been on Enron. And so that kind of shows you that, in a sense, you know, crime does pay if you get caught, but then somebody who's worse than you gets caught right after you. So I don't know. It's kind of good to see someone like Bernard Ebbers get 25 years in prison. However, Bernard Ebbers wasn't alone in coming up with the WorldCom scandal accounting fraud. It's all part of the capitalist corporate structure.
Yeah,
really, it's this whole infrastructure that supported it, from the accounting firms that advised him to the investment companies that signed on to these phony partnerships and stuff for Enron. There's just a whole big infrastructure that makes it possible for major corporations to get around the rules, and very little has been done to change that.
And it would be hard to believe that he would actually serve the full 25 years based on previous examples.
No, but you know, he's in his 60s, so any time that he serves now is going to take a big bite out of his health and out of his life. So it is kind of good to see somebody who had the ultimate authority in making those decisions get a sentence like 25 years in prison. And at this point, he may actually die while he's in prison. So...
All right.
I want to know what tattoo he's going to get.
Or if he's going to teach
money.
Cooking classes like Martha Stewart.
Or if he does come out and do classes in morality like Michael Milken did.
Yeah, so. We'll see.
All right. Well,
corporate ethics.
Jumping over then to international and this week in Iraq.
This week there was more evidence of torture by Iraqi security forces. In a district in northern Baghdad, angry residents buried three men who were among a group of 13 to 14 men arrested by Iraqi police on Monday, but then who were found dead in a morgue on Tuesday evening, their bodies covered with signs of beatings and torture. On Tuesday, there were several angry street demonstrations broke out around the country, particularly in Sunni areas, as the news came out that 12 Sunni construction workers from western Baghdad had been seized by Iraqi police in a nearby hospital and held for 4 hours locked inside of a police van in the sun in 120-degree heat. All of them died except for one. Their bodies were only discovered and finally removed from the van after the sole survivor awoke from a dead faint and used his cell phone to call for help. The victims were all relatives, friends, and co-workers of two men who had been shot by U.S. troops. Interestingly, it wasn't U.S. troops who tracked down the two men in the hospital and arrested their relatives and friends and co-workers. It was the Iraqi police. Although no one can tell the reporters who reported on this subject, no one could tell them what these men were charged with and why they weren't taken immediately to a police station but were locked in a police van instead. It's pretty clear to me, at least, that, and of course to all of the people who were protesting this week, that Iraqi police need more training. Now, at the same time, Operation Lightning, folks might remember what Operation Lightning was. It started about 6 or 7 weeks ago when the Iraqi government said that they were going to surround the city of Baghdad with a ring of troops and checkpoints in order to keep the insurgents out and to prevent things like suicide bombings happening inside Baghdad.
It's worked really well, too.
Yeah, it hasn't worked so well. In June, the number of car bombings did fall by almost half from record levels in May. However, in May, the number of car bombings were 70. In June, the number was 40 inside the city of Baghdad. So that's not exactly a success. There was a lot less mortar fire around the center of the city in the green zone, which must have made President Talabani feel a little bit better. But this week saw another upsurge in car bombings this week in early July. There was a brutal one on Thursday that killed 27 people, most of them children. And there were at least 10 coordinated car bombings on Friday, that's yesterday, that killed at least 25 people and wounded more than 100 inside the capital city of Baghdad. Also, we shouldn't forget to mention there was a triple suicide bombing at the entrance to the Green Zone on Thursday. We can't forget to mention that there was a car bomb on a bridge overlooking President Talabani's home that killed three of his guards this week. So, in spite of Operation Lightning, it's pretty clear that security is out of control all over the capital city of Baghdad, with the added risk now for Baghdad citizens of getting swept up in a mass arrest by Iraqi security forces, with the possibility of beatings, torture, and potentially being locked in a police van and suffocated to death.
Actually, I think being cooked alive is...
Cooked alive is probably a better way to describe it, yeah. Meanwhile, the Bush administration appears to be happy to leave Iraqi citizens to the fate that we've imposed on them. There was another British memo leaked this week that said that indeed there is a timeline for troop withdrawal from Iraq. This memo was written by the British Defense Minister John Reid. It says that both U.S. and Britain are planning to reduce troop levels in Iraq to 66,000 from about 140,000 by, get this, early 2006. That's within about 6 months. Now, the Bush administration still denies that there's any such timeline, but the Pentagon has been planning for troop reductions for some time now. And it's obviously not contingent on the training of Iraqi troops and police forces, unless, of course, you consider kneecapping, strangulation, and cigarette burns as your criteria for successful training. As one Iraqi citizen told Time magazine this past week, he said, quote, "We have oil, but no gasoline. We have rivers, but no water. We have guns, but no security." And that wraps up this week in Iraq.
All right. You had some info on the Fortune 500 companies.
Yeah, the real winners in the war on terrorism. Jeff, if you had to guess, who would you say were the real winners in the war on terrorism?
Halliburton, Bechtel.
Pretty close.
ExxonMobil.
Yeah, you're getting closer. It's interesting. He mentioned defense contractors and an oil company because Fortune 500 released its rankings of the top 500 companies in the world this week, the largest companies by revenues. And I'm just going to read the list so you can see who the real winners in the war on terrorism are. Number one on the list is Walmart, which is where folks go when there's a recession and you can't afford to buy things anywhere else. Number two is BP. That's what, an oil company?
Mm-hmm.
Number three is ExxonMobil, another oil company. Number four is Royal Dutch Shell. It's another oil company. Number five is General Motors. That's a car company. Number six is Daimler Chrysler, a car company. Number seven is, Toyota. It's another car company. Number eight, Ford Motor, another car company. Number nine, General Electric, world's largest defense contractor. Number 10 is Total, that's a French oil company. Number 11 is Chevron, another oil company. Number 12 is ConocoPhillips, that's another oil company. And on and on and on and on. This is what you see when you look at who's really profited in the last year. Over the current situation that we have.
Well, you'd never know we had an energy crisis based on how many energy companies are there. And
how many energy and car companies there are.
But those car companies produced more than just civilian vehicles.
That's true. A lot of them also are defense contractors. Now, the interesting thing, too, is that every year, if you look at the Fortune 500 listing, usually within the top five, you have several car companies. So that's not unusual. What's interesting is that the oil companies are bumping them out of the top 10. They're bumping them lower down and some of them out of the top 10, which is unusual. But I think it's something we could expect now with George Bush in office, having been an oil company executive himself.
Well, and with oil topping $60 a barrel, that's highly profitable for oil companies.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because when the war in Iraq started, the Bush administration was very careful to assure the U.S. public that there wasn't going to be any rise in the price of oil, that, in fact, the price of oil was going to stay down around, what was it, $20 a barrel back then in the good old days, So...
It's also interesting to note that the U.S. is the lead country in resisting the Kyoto Protocols and any changes to offset global warming. And, of course, a key contributor to global warming is our...
The automobile industry.
Automobile and oil
industry. Yeah, no, and then the automobile industry is right behind those initiatives to push the Bush administration not to sign on to Kyoto and not to admit that global warming is caused by human activity, because the very first thing that would have to happen then would be major investment in research and development by the automobile companies to try to reduce auto emissions.
Yeah. By the way, there was an interesting announcement this week by the Sierra Club and I think a number of different environmental groups announcing a national boycott against ExxonMobil, and the specific reason they gave was its intransigence on global warming. Mm-hmm. Its efforts to lobby the Bush administration to not take any action on global warming.
Yeah, other oil companies tend to have a little campaign to kind of make their image a little bit greener. ExxonMobil doesn't even bother.
No,
doesn't
they don't
even bother. That's not to say other oil companies are actually greener. Many of them also continue to support the same things that ExxonMobil does. It's just that ExxonMobil doesn't even try to give lip service.
And they're also the largest of the oil companies.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're, in fact, the Fortune 500 rankings are by total revenues, but if you look at profitability, how much actual profit after expenses, revenue is before you subtract expenses. If you subtract expenses and look at the most profitable companies, ExxonMobil is number one with something like $25.3 billion in total profit for 2004. That is obscene by just about any measure.
Well, it's also interesting to note that, you know, while everybody, at least in this state, or a significant number of people in this state, are getting upset over the proposed or the now initiated gas tax increase of, 9 cents over, you know, X number of years, the oil companies are the ones that primarily are the ones that caused the increase in the price of gas.
Yeah. And it's interesting.
And no one gets upset about that.
Yeah, because the price of gas goes up and down. You know, before the price of oil can really trickle through the system. So it's what you see is, you know, the price of oil goes up by, you know, a dollar or half a dollar or something, and then immediately you see that change at the pump before the expensive gas has had a chance to come through the system. So pretty clearly the price of gas goes up and down according to what retailers and what wholesalers think the market will bear, what people are able to pay.
It's very much what the market will bear. In fact, in many parts of the country, I was back in the Midwest in May, and they were paying $2 a gallon for gas at a time when it was 2.5 here. It was, you know, 50 cents cheaper in the Midwest than it was on the West Coast at the same time.
Yeah, and then they say it's because of distribution and problems with refining and so forth, and that's bull. I mean, it's mostly because they look at what they think people can afford to pay, and they charge that. And they're not looking at what they think poor people can afford to pay. They look at what they think, you know, the top half
middle class
can pay.
The
yeah.
market.
Uh-huh. The market, which is often usually who they consider consumers, and that doesn't include the bottom half of people, the bottom half of people in the economy. It usually includes only the top half, and so they price it for that. So folks who are having to work, you know, two jobs to make it, you know, who can't afford to buy a house, who have to drive really, really old beater cars that tend to consume a lot more gas, those folks are really on the edge right now, and a lot of it has to do with the price of gas.
Well, I'd wanted to work this in weeks ago, but it works out fine now. There is an alternative, at least in terms of purchasing gas, where your money can go not to the largest, at least I'm pretty sure they're not making the top 10 list that you just quoted, but in the greater Seattle area, there's a company called Citgo, which is a subsidiary of the Venezuelan oil company that there's like five stations here locally.
This is at a time when the Bush administration is trying to shut Venezuela out of the U.S. market, and Venezuela is actually pretty happy to sell their oil someplace else. They're not exactly happy with the Bush administration's interference in Venezuelan politics.
Yeah, to clarify for people who know, Citgo was originally an American company. The Venezuelan oil company, state national oil company, bought them out about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So if you see a Citgo station, it's a place you can buy gas that isn't giving your dollars to somebody like ExxonMobil or ConocoPhillips or Royal Dutch Shell or BP or any of the other huge oil companies that are on the Fortune 500 list.
I know there's 5 of them here in Seattle, and you can find out where there's one near you from their website, which is CITGO, I believe?
Yes,
I
CITGO.
CITGO.com.
Mm-hmm.
All right, just a couple minutes left. Update on the London bombings? Anything of interest?
Yeah, At first, investigators in London thought that the bombs had simply been planted and the people who had left them had walked away from the scene, gotten off the trains and the buses. Now they think they are suicide bombings, which would be probably the first time.
In Europe.
Yeah, the first time that suicide bombings of that type have happened in Europe. In addition, it turns out the main suspects, and I'm going to call them suspects, even though the press seems to think it's a foregone conclusion that these guys have done it, the main suspects are four young men, relatively young men, who were born in Britain of Pakistani descent, three of them at least. One is a Jamaican descent. And it's been a shock to the British to the British press and to the British people that British-born kids, essentially 18, 22-year-olds, can feel this kind of resentment and want to do this kind of thing. Now, in the press reports, we see descriptions of these guys as, you know, they use words like kind, quiet, pleasant, sweet, fun, kinds of people, ordinary people. Now, another interesting thing that's pointed out is that at least two of them traveled abroad within the past year, where there is a very, very different view of the U.S.'s role in the world and Britain's role in the world, particularly in the Middle East. There's a lot more discontent over what's been going on in Iraq and in Israel and Palestine in the rest of the world than there is inside the U.S. and inside Britain, and that has a tendency to change the way people think about politics and business as usual inside the U.S. and the U.K.
The other thing I thought was interesting, someone had forwarded to me the end of last week, actually last Sunday, about a British security guy who was being former Scotland Yard, who was being interviewed on the BBC 5 radio network the day of.
Yes.
And he had been saying that his security firm was running some type of operation the day of in exactly the same stations, just minutes before these different bombings occurred. I don't know how much there is to this, but they actually linked to the interview with this guy. It was just kind of interesting.
Interesting thing.
Yeah, although I would caution from leaping from that to the conclusion that is attached itself to this in a lot of the emails making the rounds of the internet saying that this was an inside job.
Right,
although,
but I think it does deserve some
it raises some questions.
Yeah,
it raises some questions.
Yeah. And then there is the discovery this past week, too, that from a chemical analysis of the explosions, that the material that was used to cause the explosions is military in origin. They can tell that by the chemical analysis, which has really been a shocker to the British police, that these kids didn't sit in a basement and whip up these bombs with homemade stuff. They got this material somehow from a military source. So they're trying to think, well, could it have been somebody in the British military that supplied them? Could they have gotten them from the Balkans? Could they have brought them back from Pakistan? You know, where did the stuff come from? That's another big question.
All right. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time. There is one event happening today we wanted to let you know about. There is a memorial today for Andy Stevenson at 2 o'clock at Town Hall. He is a local activist on voting fraud, voting rights, and he passed away, I believe, last week from cancer.
Yes.
All right. And he's been on the show before. He worked with Bev Harris at Black Box Voting. So, again, that's 2 o'clock at Seattle Town Hall. And with that, talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State, and tell people where they can find Eat the State.
Eat the State comes out every couple weeks, although we're taking a week break this time around. We're going to go to every third week during the summer. so that we can take some vacations. I'll be out the next couple of weeks myself. You can find it also where you find free publications, anywhere around town, bookstores, cafes, places like that, or on the web, because we have our current issues and all of our back issues, or at least most of our back issues, on the web at www.eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips that you'd like to help out, we can always use volunteers, we can always use donations, let us know, www.eatthestate.org.
And congratulations on your wedding, Jav.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, congratulations.